Heads up, Basic Brewing Radio listeners, the American Homebrewers Association has a special deal just for you. Join the AHA or renew your membership in the month of August, and you'll receive a free copy of Designing Great Beers by Ray Daniels, one of my favorite beer books. Just head over to homebrewersassociation.org, click Join, and use the offer code BBR at checkout. With Zymergy Magazine, money-saving member deals, and access to exclusive events, including the National Homebrew Competition, the AHA is an indispensable resource for new and veteran homebrewers alike. Visit homebrewersassociation.org, use code BBR, and claim your free book today. Offer ends August 31st. Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, August 6th. 2015. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. This week, we visit Modern Times Brewing in San Diego to talk to founder Jacob McKean and mad fermentationist Mike Tonsmeyer about starting a commercial brewery from a homebrew foundation, coffee beers, and sour beers, of course. Lots of great stuff. If you're new to home brewing and would like to get into the hobby for the first time, check out our website, basicbrewing.com. where you can find archives of our audio and video podcasts and our DVDs to walk you through basic and more advanced brewing techniques. And if you buy any of our DVD combos, you'll get a free Basic Brewing bottle opener. You can follow me on Twitter. My username is Basic Brewing, all one word. We have a Basic Brewing radio and Basic Brewing video page on Facebook at facebook.com/basicbrewing. We're on the Google Plus as well. Thanks again, everybody, clicking on the Amazon.com associate link on our basicbrewing.com site. Whenever you think of Amazon, think of us. Click on our associate link first. It won't cost you any extra, and you'll be helping us to bring you the show, and we greatly, greatly appreciate your support. You can find our Basic Brewing iPhone app on iTunes, our Android app on Amazon.com. We have a Windows Phone app. We're on the BlackBerry podcast directory. We're on the Stitcher app as well. And if you want to put a tip in our tip jar, some coinage in our guitar case, you can go to basicbrewing.com/support. Thanks to everybody who's done so already. I'm in a bit of a hurry to get to the interview this week for three reasons. First of all, there's a ton of great info. It was a really good conversation. Two, we talked for a good long time. And three, I'm recording this a bit ahead of time, as I will next week as well. We got some family things to take care of to end the summer and get ready for the upcoming school year. So no mailbag, unfortunately, for this week. Sorry about that. But I thought recording these ahead of the time is much better than, you know, skipping a week or two of the show. You know, whenever somebody has a list of things, list of reasons for something, it's always the last reason that's the most important. I think I've said that on the show. I do want to take time to talk about our ongoing sponsors, Dave and Desiree from High Gravity in Tulsa. Now, I've bragged about High Gravity's website, highgravitybrew.com, and here are some more reasons to check it out. First of all, $7.99 shipping on most items. There you go. The very handy Build Your Own Beer feature, which lets you select all your ingredients from one page, including adjuncts, yeast, priming options, fruit flavorings, and purees even. And as you build your recipe on that one page, your total always stays at the bottom of the page. It's very, very neat. You can even name your beer. And on top of that, you can reorder your ingredients from your account management page. So if there are recipes that you always like to have on tap, reordering the ingredients for those recipes is easy. And for your family, you can create a Get Me This registry to let friends and family know what you would like for your birthday or other gift-giving occasions. Everybody wins on that one. For example, if you want a refractometer and your family has no idea what a refractometer is, you can send them to this page, this Get Me This registry. And hey, if you're getting married, you know, along with the dishes and the silver and all that, get some brewing stuff. Start that marriage off on the right foot. Check it all out at highgravitybrew.com. Now, I've been wanting to go to Modern Times ever since I heard Mike Tonsmeyer was collaborating with Jacob McKean to design the beers that would be the basis for their business. And so it was a great opportunity to go with Mike to Modern Times while we were there in San Diego for the National Homebrewers Conference. Modern Times is not only brewing great beer, but for you coffee lovers, they're roasting coffee for use in their own beers and for sale in retail bags. And we talked to Jacob about that as well, not only brewing coffee, but using it in beers. And they're even playing with barrel aging coffee beans. Huh? Have a listen. All right, here we are at Modern Times Brewing Company. Jacob McKean, welcome to Basic Brewing Radio.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
And Mike Tonsmeyer, welcome back.
Happy as always.
So, Jacob, describe your relationship with Mike Tonsmeyer. How did you guys get introduced or hooked up together, and what's been Mike's role in your brewery?
Sure. So, early on, well before I had any plans to start a brewery, I was a big fan of Mike's blog. I was a very obsessive home brewer. I was brewing every weekend at one point. And, you know, I just reached out to Mike and said, you know, I'm sick of reading about this stuff. I have to try it. I have to know if, like, it's as good as it sounds on paper. And so we worked out a trade where I sent him commercial beer from San Diego that he was excited to try, and he sent me back a bunch of his home brews that I was excited to try. And, you know, then we exchanged tasting notes, and we found that we were very much on the same page philosophically and as far as our palate goes and that sort of thing. And there was just a lot of overlap in what was exciting for us and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, we maintained kind of a casual beer nerd relationship while I was still working at Stone, which is where I was at prior to starting Modern Times. And then, you know, when I left Stone with their blessing and support, which was great, first person I reached out to was Mike and said, you know, hey, I'm going to be spending almost all of my time raising money, finalizing the business plan, finding a location, doing construction, all this. You know, and the more and more I think about this, where is the time in the day for me to be brewing pilot batches to, you know, dial in what will become our core lineup? And, you know, Mike thought the project sounded exciting, and we very quickly agreed to work together as partners on figuring out what this core lineup would look like, and a little bit beyond that as well, although I think the task ended up taking us a little bit longer than we had anticipated. So, you know, starting from there, we began discussing what the core lineup should look like. I obviously had a sort of palette of options to work from, and we sort of whittled that down to, you know, what we were excited about, but also what made sense as a brewery and all that kind of thing. And then we just got right into formulating recipes, and Mike did the brewing and would send me boxes of his homebrew, and I would send him back tasting notes, and then we would just iterate from there. It was an evolution, and, you know, we would sometimes get very, very granular into the recipes, and then other times it was easier on certain beers than on others. And then once we kind of considered something done, we both understood that, you know, once this was scaled up, there were still going to be further changes that would be made, but we were happy with, like, more or less where that thing had ended up, and then we'd move on to the next one. And so that was, I think, a really exciting process for both of us, because as a home brewer, certainly for me, and I know for Mike as well, like, it's pretty rare that you take a recipe and try to perfect it, right? Like, one of the joys of homebrewing is the unlimited variety. Yeah, like, there's no one telling you that, like, you have to keep trying until you get it exactly there. So that was unique for both of us, for sure. But
there were different sorts of tweaks, too. When you're a homebrewer, you know, who cares if you use a different strain of yeast or a different base malt for every beer? And what we started out with was the idea that we would try to brew the perfect beer, and then we would sort of adjust it back. And I think what I really learned is, if I had to do it again, I probably wouldn't go through that. I would probably start out knowing that, hey, okay, we're going to use American Pale as our base. Don't touch Maris Otter. Don't touch, you know, whatever. Because it just ends up sort of being heartbreaking when you make a change after you've got the recipe where you want, then you go, okay, let's see it with American Two-Row, because that's what we're going to have to do. Oh, man, that even in, we were expecting a stout, really wouldn't matter. You know what, with base malt, then a stout with seven other malts, who cares? But it really did make a difference, and it took the brewers a couple of batches to do some tweaks and add some more malts and back some things off and do some water adjustments. And
yeah. So there were some compromises that you had to make because of being a commercial operation that had, you know, you can buy expensive malt for a 5-gallon batch of beer, and you can throw a bunch of it in the mash tun. Yeah. It doesn't matter. But this is a huge operation. I mean, you've got some giant, in my book, fermenters you know, back in the back of this huge space.
Right.
So you had to, how would that process work out?
Well, I mean, it was, there was compromise inherent in the entire process from the very beginning. And yeah, that it's simply the logistics of commercial brewing on this scale. And, you know, we knew going into it, of course, that modern times, the goal here is to be essentially like a populist operation, right? It's world-class beer for that, that is accessible to the average Joe. You know, like that was the dream, right? Is to take these kind of these styles and that we loved, but that were somewhat niche, and create a platform for them where, you know, the average person within our geographical footprint would be able to get them at the average store, right? And then, of course, we also do many specialty things, but for the core lineup, that was the dream. And so inherent in that is that these things have to be scalable to create a lot of them, right?
There's got concern about how much the Marisar would have cost, and more about that we wanted one base mold, so now they're putting in a silo.
Yeah,
you can
exactly
have one silo.
Yeah.
If we wanted to do all English beers, Marisar would have been no problem, but where you're trying to do a Saison and hoppy beers and a stout with one base malt, that's really where the trick comes in.
Yeah, it's the economy of scale.
Yeah, it's economy of scale, and also just, I mean, the raw logistics of making this much beer demand a certain simplification of these things, right? Like, we have two yeasts that we work with on a regular basis, and if we had done three, you know, if we had used an English ale yeast for the oatmeal coffee stuff like that, our life would have become exponentially more difficult, right? These are things that are just not a problem for homebrewers, and were certainly not a problem for me when I was homebrewing. And you really have, like, there's no time when you have more freedom than when you are brewing for yourself. You know, when you are a subsistence brewer making beer for you to drink, that is the ultimate freedom. When you are trying to make 20,000 barrels of something, there is a great deal of constraint in how you do that. Although, you know, I think there's really a fascinating problem-solving process that goes into figuring out how to make that much of something that is still every bit as good as the 5-gallon batch. And that's really what we spend a great deal of our energy and time doing, is making sure that as these things scale, what made them special in the first place does not change. And in many cases, we've even managed to improve, right? Like, you have access to incredible tools and resources when you're at this size. You know, probably the simplest example is that when we were formulating these, we decided to use CO2 extract for all the 60-minute additions for the bittering. The CO2 extract that you can access as a home brewer is like a sad imitation of the CO2 extract that you can access as a production brewery. You know, so what we're able to get now is just worlds apart from what we were working with. And there was some frustration for us around, like, this product is just not performing the way we want it to. We know the potential is there, but the execution has just not been scaled down to the 5-gallon recipe. So that's just one example of how we've managed to make a process improvement as we've scaled up. And I think in most people's minds, they only think about the compromises as you scale up, not necessarily as the improvements. And we found it's a
little going to buy to get, you know, pick out the hop lots in Yakima. That really, it's been amazing. I've been much more cognizant of when I open a pack of Simcoe, smelling it, and I find myself probably throwing out a quarter or maybe 20% of the hops that I buy because they don't smell good. It's even in the same lot. I was just doing a beer with Galaxy, and I opened up three packs. Two of them smelled great. One of them smelled like old leaves. Threw it out, opened another one, fine, and then same thing again happened when I went to dry hop. And I've done some bad Galaxy beers, and I really, now I believe it's just I hadn't been paying enough attention to smelling that Galaxy that was not packaged process, you know, correctly, or there was some other issue with it.
You know, for a lot of the vendors, there's a minimum of 5,000 pounds on your contract before you're allowed to go up to Yakima and select the lots. So that is another instance where having a bigger scale actually gets you access to better stuff than you would get otherwise. You know, as homebrewers, yeah, as Mike said, we're limited to buying these sad little baggies of, beat up hops a lot of the time. Whereas here, you know, we get the nitrogen flushed Mylar bag filled with the hops that we selected when we went up to the hop growing region, and we know that those hops are going to be on point and on the profile that we're looking for and all that kind of thing.
So you're actually going up and cutting bales and
well, they do the cutting for us, but yeah.
Jacob doesn't get his hands dirty anymore.
But yeah, I mean, that's, you know, one of the, I guess there are a lot of little things like that, and when you add up a dozen of those little things, you're talking about a huge difference.
And not to mention just the repeatability. I mean, we were talking about brewing these same beers 2, 3, 4 times at my house. Now these brewers are doing some of these beers weekly, and, you know, you learn exactly those subtle tweaks to the water chemistry or to hop timing or to, hey, you know, I think a lot of homebrewers think of a lot of things as a commodity. Hey, I'm using Cara Viena. Well, which Cara Viena? And we had some arguments over, do we want Brice Cara Viena or Franco-Belge, and what are the different characteristics? And I think those are the really important things that, you know, commercial brewers do. They really learn the ingredients so intimately in a way may homebrewers don't.
Yeah, and, you know, as a homebrewer, like, I was never looking at the analysis of the particular lot of two-row that I was buying, right? But here, like, you have to, or else, like, your gravity is going to be widely off, or whatever it is. Like, there are major issues like that where, and having a larger staff, frankly, like, growth also helps in that regard, right? Like, I personally do not have a master's in microbiology, but I've got a guy who works here who does, you know? And so there is a benefit to the consumer to our being able to access those types of resources. So it's a learning process. You know, on the one hand, what we sacrifice in flexibility that we sometimes make up for in consistency and quality and access to good ingredients and that kind of thing. It's fascinating. I mean, it's just, it's so different. You know, imagine the difference between mixing up a bucket of concrete to put some stones in your garden versus owning a concrete factory. You know, like, they're almost unrelated in certain ways.
It's amazing. The nerdiest brewers that I talked to, and a bunch of the guys here last night, they were cutting open. Somebody had shown up with a can of beer from another company, and they were cutting it open and measuring the seam to see what the seal was like, and arguing over how much dissolved oxygen should be in there. And this is the sort of thing that really great professional brewers are concerned about. They're not as excited about some new hop variety or some, like, they certainly, that's part of it, but really it's about process, and particularly a place like this, about making those core beers consistently, and sure, doing some fun things once in a while, but, you know, not at the expense of the beers that are on the shelves everywhere.
So let's talk about the core beers. I mean, what beers did you design, and how did y'all come up with that list and all that?
Yeah, I mean, Jacob had a big old list of, you know, beer styles that not only he enjoyed, commercial beers that he enjoyed, names that he was thinking about, beers that maybe there's a spot missing for it in the San Diego market. And we really just went back and forth, you know, and a lot of it is, it's less about big flavor concepts and more like, hey, you want beer? I really like that beer. But you know what beer has a better hop character than that? This one. Hey, why don't we try that base beer with this hop character? And some of those actually ended up pretty close to that. And other ones, I mean, one of our beers was based on Trogues Nugget Nectar, and there's literally no ingredients in common with Nugget Nectar now that it's in production. The malt's different, the yeast is different, all the hops are different. That was just sort of the jumping off point. We wanted something that had some malt, had some color to it, big, bold, hoppy flavor. But what we ended up wanting was something very different than the original beer. That was just sort of the spark of inspiration. And then we sort of, with repeated rebrewings, and then honestly, that was one of the ones that changed the most. That one, I had originally been doing pale chocolate in it because I wanted a little bit of more of a toasty thing. And the problem with that beer, the first batch was delicious for 3 weeks, maybe 4 weeks on tap. And then it was like 1929 stock market crash. It was just... Yeah. Just really, you know, bottomed out, and now they switched to Midnight Wheat, I think was last I heard, and that really seems to give you that great color without monstrously, you know, destroying the hops.
Yeah. I mean, there was, the whole process of figuring this stuff out was fascinating and fun and interesting, and one of the things that influenced me in deciding, like, what made the list was, you know, I'd lived in Pennsylvania where you can only, the whole rules around buying beer there are just, like, incredibly annoying. Because of that, I ended up buying a lot of beer by the case, which forced me to rethink the way I approach beer, right? So much about the beer scene now is about buying, you know, that single bomber. And, you know, even buying a single six-pack is considered, like, a huge commitment. But living in Pennsylvania was, like, options were substantially scarcer than that. And so buying an entire case of something was the norm. And so I had to think about, you know, which of these beers would I really want to be buying by the case and not be sick of by the time I got to that last six-pack. And, you know, our core lineup is more focused on more sessionable gravities, and that was really influenced by that experience, right? Wanting to brew things that people wanted to drink by the pint repeatedly, and they would still be as excited about it, you know, after drinking it for years as they were the first time. And so I think we really managed to whittle down this kind of very broad starting point into a focused, coherent lineup that accomplishes that. So that was the big dream, was like a little bit more sessionable styles, but compromising nothing in flavor and aroma, and the beers are all very, very focused on aroma. I describe them as kind of new wave in that way. Like, we don't go for the sledgehammer bitterness, the high ABV. We tend to focus on hop varietal character more than, like, bitterness and generic hoppiness.
Yeah.
We pay a lot of attention to aroma, so especially on the dry hop beers, on the coffee beer as well, and then picking a very character-forward yeast for our Saison, all that stuff. So, I think it's... You know, now when Mike and I talk about, like, where we started on some of these things, it feels like a world away from today. But at the same time, I think we really did succeed at kind of whittling down this broad concept into a, you know, functioning product.
So we're standing next to a coffee roaster.
Yep.
And you guys are not only roasting coffee for your beers, you're also selling bagged coffee.
Yeah.
And doing some interesting stuff with that. Did you move into that because you wanted to take complete control over your product, or how did you get into that?
So that was part of it, certainly, but ironically, when I gave up homebrewing to Mike, essentially, when I, like, outsourced my homebrewing hobby to Mike, I needed a new hobby, because I spent all day, you know, going through this, like, incredibly draining, difficult experience of opening the brewery, but I still love the process of tinkering. And I was a geek for coffee, but I had never had any experience with roasting or any of that stuff. And my girlfriend and I started home roasting. Home roasting is a much more lightweight hobby than home brewing. A lot less cleanup time, a lot less waiting. A lot less commitment. It can be done, you know, kind of on the lark. And that just kind of planted the seed of, you know, the same way that home brewing had planted the seed of the brewery. And so when we got about halfway through the process of starting the brewery and I realized just how much coffee we were going to have to buy to keep a year-round oatmeal coffee stout as part of our core lineup, I just thought, you know, this isn't in the business plan. This is not part of the agenda. I haven't talked to anyone else about this, but how cool would it be if we roasted our own coffee? And so I found a coffee roaster on Craigslist.
Not this one.
Not the one we're standing next to, a much smaller one. I bought it, asked my girlfriend if she was interested in doing the roasting, because she had already surpassed me very quickly on the coffee side. She was working at a local coffee roasting company. She was extremely passionate about coffee and roasting. You know, she thought it sounded really exciting. And so we just kind of did it. We just jumped in. That was probably one of the only things about this place that was not very carefully calculated. But then as soon as we started selling bags of our coffee beans, the whole thing kind of blew up and became its own deal. And now Modern Times Coffee is kind of its own production in a way. It has its own staff. It has its own brand. I mean, it's and that's just been strictly in response to organic demand from our customers. So, yes, it does allow a tremendous amount of control we could never have if we were buying roasted coffee, both in origin, you know, where we source the beans from, how we roast them, how we add them to the coffee, when.
Yeah.
I mean, that makes a big difference, especially with some of the weirder stuff like the barrel-aged beans. Things get very particular about when and how they're roasted and how long they rest for, because, you know, coffee is very volatile right after it's roasted, and so knowing exactly the right point to add it to the beer is very important. But then, you know, also I just think there's a lot of similarity between craft beer and specialty coffee, and the types of people who like craft beer tend to have very adventurous palates and they like to try new things, and I think this is a really cool way to create some crossover between these two worlds that have a lot in common but I think culturally are pretty different. So it's just been really cool to introduce craft beer fans to the world of specialty coffee and vice versa. And then we're always using beer as a platform to get people excited about our coffee. So anytime we do a new single origin release or a new blend or whatever it is, we try to make a beer involving that coffee in it. And it's just been super fun. And
great crossover too, right? To have the coffee on at bars and then maybe, you know, that gets the name out there a little bit more. Encourages them to have the coffee stout on because we're serving the beer and selling the Black House blend coffee and now the seasonal coffees. And
I mean, especially with events. I mean, when we do events, especially at places that are, like, kind of adventurous cocktail bars, that kind of thing, they'll often, like, whip up a cocktail using our nitro cold brew along with beer, and they'll have, like, barrel-aged, you know, yada yada. Like, it gets really interesting. So we have bars that buy single barrels of, say, whiskey for their cocktail program. They'll then give us the barrel, will then age coffee in it, roast the coffee, and then go back to the bar with the keg of cold brew made with the, you know, There's just so many opportunities to do cool things that would otherwise not exist.
Okay, how do you barrel age a coffee?
Excellent question. So we have a blog post about it. The blog post will explain this better than I can now, but so if you go to moderntimesbeer.com, look through the blog. There's loads of information on there, including some stuff from Mike that's really interesting. So the long and short of it is that green, unroasted coffee beans are extremely porous. Usually that's a bad thing because the beans will pick up character from the warehouses that they're stored in, the boats they're shipped on, the forklifts that are operating near them, whatever it is.
I recently read that one of the European, maybe Peugeot, used to make a non-diesel tractor simply for coffee plantation so that they wouldn't pick up the diesel fumes.
Wow. So they're very delicate, and within the specialty coffee world, a great deal of time and attention has been put into figuring out how to transport and process coffee from origin to the roaster without picking up any flavor. This is all a very good thing. But you can use the same sort of structural weakness to impart desirable character to the beans. So, what we figured out was that if you put green unroasted coffee in a very fragrant but otherwise completely dry used spirits barrel, somewhere between 1 and 4 months, it will pick up a lot of the character without having to come into contact with any of the liquid. So you get big oak notes, a lot of spirit character. It's fascinating, and each barrel is different. So at this point, we've done many different variations on this. We've done rye barrels, bourbon barrels, Madeira barrels, red wine barrels, port barrels, on and on and on, and each one has been a fascinating experience. And then we've also done beers with those beans. So that's another thing that we have access to that would otherwise, I honestly have no idea where we would get it, especially at the price point that we charge. We have this unique opportunity to create bourbon barrel aged coffee beans, which have this just like unmatched character, then add them to, say, a Nicaraguan dark rum barrel aged 12% imperial stout. And then you've got barrel upon barrel, right? You've got the barrel-aged coffee beans, the barrel-aged beer, and then the combination of those two is just like a flavor that literally, I can't imagine what the comparison would be, but, it's fascinating, and it creates these very interesting beers. And so I just think the barrel-aging program for our coffee and for our beer have created just stuff that I had never imagined going into it.
Okay, when you're roasting a barrel-aged green coffee bean, is there a point where you start losing that barrel flavor and character? So, I mean, are we talking lightly roasted beans at that point?
Yes, definitely lightly roasted. The technical details would be better explained by Amy than by me, but I'll tell you that, there's a sweet spot, and that sweet spot is definitely on the lighter side of the roast.
Like around the first crack, or?
Just after, probably. Yeah, but it depends also on the bean, right? So what you're putting into the barrel to begin with is going to have a huge influence, whether that's a naturally processed, a wet processed, whether it's a high-grown hard bean, whether it's a low-grown tropical bean, et cetera. So there's many variables involved in this, and it's also about, what you're trying to accomplish in the end result. So we roast differently for beer than we do for drinking coffee. We also blend differently. We have different origins that we like to use for, a prepared cup versus a beer. The ABV of the beer makes a huge difference, too. Yeah.
So In what way?
Well, the higher the ABV, the more coffee it soaks up, as a general rule. But, it also depends, of course, on what specialty malts you're putting in there as well. So the more, like, what I would say is, as a general rule, the more, like, native character the beer has, the more coffee you're going to have to use to cut through that character to have a presentable coffee beer. If we were to add coffee at the same rate to our Imperial Stout as we did to our 5.8% oatmeal coffee stout, you would barely know there was coffee in it. So we have to do about 2.5 times as much coffee into that as we do into the 5.8% oatmeal coffee stout.
Okay, 100 questions come. What's the difference between roasting for a cup of coffee to roasting for a beer?
Again, this would be like Amy would have the better, more intelligent answer to this. But, in general, there's no one easy answer to that. But, here are some things to consider. When you're putting, the way we add coffee to our beer is we essentially dry hop with it. We take whole bean coffee, freshly roasted, and add it to the beer as though it were dry hops in giant bags, right? And we tested many different extraction methods for that, making cold brew concentrate, ground coffee into beer, etc. Did blind tasting of all this stuff, and hands down the winner was whole bean into cold beer.
It's pretty quick, too. Yeah,
24 to 48 hours. Yeah, otherwise you get some weird... So here's the thing, right? When you extract coffee with hot water, what is pulling the flavor and aroma out of that is the heat of the water itself and the minerality, pH, etc. of the water, and then the mechanical process of the water moving through the beans, right? When you're cold extracting whole beans into beer, you're putting that coffee into an environment with a totally different pH. There's alcohol, there's protein, there's sugar, there are tons of things. There's CO2, obviously, in solution. Yeah, it's colder usually than you would extract water, and there's a lot more for the coffee to interact with. There's also a lot more in there that is a naturally acting solvent that's going to take things out of the coffee. That may be desirable, may be undesirable, depending on the bean, depending on, you know, a lot of different factors. So I would say every beer is different and every coffee bean is different, but in general, you're talking about putting coffee into a solution that is just a world apart from hot water.
And so post-fermentation, obviously, yeah. Would you do it like in a bright tank, or would you do it...
We do it in fermenters, but you could certainly do it in a bright tank. I won't lie to you. We have picked a labor-intensive, difficult way of doing this. When these giant bags of coffee are saturated with beer and they have to be pulled out of the tank, that is not an easy or efficient task. It would definitely be much easier to make a cold brew concentrate and then just inject it into the beer, but we know what that tastes like, and we don't like it as much as the way we do.
So do you do anything interesting with the beer's soggy beans afterwards?
So remembering everything I just said about the solvent action of alcohol and all that, when the beans come out, they taste like cardboard. There is almost nothing left behind.
It's the spent grain of the coffee world.
Exactly. Yeah.
It doesn't take a huge amount of coffee. I mean, you guys are still around like 2 ounces and 5 gallons was our original rate for Black House. I mean, it's not a huge amount of coffee. For a home brewer, when you're doing a 30 or a 60 barrel batch, it's a lot of coffee. And if you're doing a lot more for Mega Black House or Monsters Park or something like that.
So for us, it's 22 pounds into 30 barrels. But the 2 ounces, I mean, when home brewers ask me, I always say 2 to 4 ounces, depending on the beer and what you're going for. But yeah, we do 2.5 times that for our Imperial Stouts and all that. So.
And you guys are doing sour things, obviously, in collaboration with anything that Tonsmeyer touches has got to be a little bit sour, right?
They were threatening me over at White Labs not to let me go back into the clean area.
This is a sour man.
No, yeah, when I was out here for 2 months, 2 years ago now, I grew some microbes and wrote down some recipes, and we had some fantastic fresh red wine barrels, so we opted for bigger beers, a brown and a red. And then those went on to fruit, and they came out last fall and were really surprisingly good, I would say. I mean, it was really surprising how a relatively, you know, simple base beer going into these barrels and sitting around for 18 months and some good fruit. It really wasn't a highly complex thing, and the blending was sort of, they tasted through the barrels, and the one barrel that was off got tossed, and the barrels that were maybe a little more bland are great candidates for fruit. There's some brewers who say you got to put your best beers get fruit because fruit's expensive. To me, I mean, you don't want to add fruit to an off beer. That fruit's not going to cover up weird, terrible flavors. Mm-hmm. You're much better saving for beer that, hey, it's not sour enough or the aroma's a little bland. That's a great candidate for fruit. And then just blending the other barrels together, and some of them were served as sort of single barrel, one-off kind of tasters, and it's been a lot of fun. And now there's more batches sitting in the barrels.
Yeah. So the vision for the sour program was always that we would have 2 dark base beers and 2 blonde or lighter base beers. And so, yeah, on the first go around, we did the red and the brown. Now we're doing kind of a lambic-ish, or what we're calling it. We haven't come up with exactly the naming scheme we'll use for that. But a lambic-ish beer and then kind of a sour saison, which I know is a sort of a contradiction in terms. But we started essentially with a saison base beer and went from there. And so going forward, the goal is to always have those 2 things kind of running in parallel, which should allow us to release sours a little bit more often. But when Mike was here for those 2 months, it seemed like every day a weird little package from Sweden or the Bay Area or somewhere would show up with other, you know, vials of cultures. And then for a while we just had this farm of carboys filled with starters, and then, you know, we had
40 cultures by the end of that summer.
It was crazy. And so we really only ended up eliminating a few of those, but we would sort of taste and smell the starters, and some of them were spectacular and others less so. And then we came up with this ridiculous idea of basically having every barrel be a different blend of cultures, with the idea being that it would be kind of a blood sport style tournament to figure out the winner, and then the winner would be propagated out to the rest of the barrels. And that was a really fascinating and cool process, and definitely not a super efficient one, but one that resulted in really great beer and a very cool learning experience for all of us. So.
And when you're starting a brewery like this and the price point on sours now, I just feel like you can't anymore just go and go to White Labs or White Yeast and get one of their generic cultures, pitch into everything and just say, oh, this is our sour beer culture now. It may not be the right culture for you, and it's not going to give you that sort of level of complexity and interest that something that has some more microbes or maybe cultured from a bottle of your favorite sour beer is going to give you. And really, when you're starting a brewery that's going to hopefully be making sour beers for the next 50 years, it's worth spending a little bit of time, a little bit of effort early on to figure out what you really want to do, rather than jumping into and getting a whole bunch of barrels filled and then go, well, none of these barrels are really that good. When you start with a real variety, and same thing at home, I mean, start with a whole bunch of different bugs. Don't set yourself in on one thing early on. And hey, if one batch isn't great, fine, toss it, and you'll have all sorts of other stuff to play with. And maybe some will be better for fruit, or some will be better for, you know, blending with something else, or whatever. I mean, lots of options.
So Steve is Steve's here, along, and Andy's here, and Sean Terrell's here. And you guys like to talk, and that's good. But what's the beer? Do you remember the beer that you're sampling, the funky beer?
That was
Universal what?
Was that Funky Universal? Yeah.
Yeah. It's a hell of a beer.
Detailed tasting notes.
Yeah, there you go. That you can put that on your whatever social media. It's a hell of a beer, Steve Oaks.
No, it's just got all that. It's just sour, but it's not like, you know, drinking vinegar. You know, it's not that sour, and it's got a nice malt base to it, a nice backbone. It's like an American pale ale, but sour. I love it.
And we've been we got to sample everything on tap here, which is
only 13 beers.
Near 13. Well, you know. So that was a wonderful experience to do. And
counting the coffees.
Yeah.
Oh.
Two coffees on tap.
Actual coffee.
Yep.
Wow. Which we may need after this. But Andy, favorites.
Yeah. I really like the hop forward beers. As I was saying earlier, it really focuses on the aromatic qualities of the beers and not so much on the kind of bitter, dank bitterness that some big bombers have nowadays. And the beers were just aromatically delicious. I really like the coffee beers. The one that was aged in the rum barrels was delicious. I think what was the name of it?
Monster's Park.
It had cocoa nibs and...
That was the vanilla bean edition.
Okay.
Aged in Caribbean rum barrels with vanilla beans. And then we also have, Black House, which is our year-round oatmeal coffee stout with cocoa nibs and vanilla beans. Coconut. I can't keep track of all this stuff.
What I really liked about all the beers, so I tasted all the flights that we did, you know, sipped a little of this and a little of that. Everything seemed to be in really well balance. Everything seemed to work together. So whatever it was that you were after, you got it. And you didn't get it so much that it hit you over the head, but also it wasn't lost. And I think that's the real art, you know, in brewing and blending. And you got it going on.
That's a big focus for us is, you know, I'm not into novelty for the sake of novelty. Like, if we're going to add something to the beer, we have to have a very clear idea of what it's going to contribute and how it's going to mesh with the other things, you know, going on in that beer. And, you know, we are very focused on creating beers that do have balance. But, you know, in some circles, the word balance is kind of a way of saying, like, oh, she's very nice. You know, it's like...
this beer has a good personality.
Yeah, right. So, I guess I... So when I hear the word balance, you know, some people are using that as kind of like a, you know.
Nothing stands out because it's bland.
Exciting, yeah. But yeah. I think in our case, what we're trying to do is having big character beers where the character, yeah, like you said, is not necessarily hitting you over the head. It's not a sledgehammer of, you know, one flavor or the other, but we're trying to create a harmonious experience that brings together a lot of different elements, and I think we've succeeded.
John, favorites?
I'm sipping the Fortunate Islands, which is the hoppy wheat beer, and was a standout for me.
That's one of the cores, right?
Beers were really well done, but this one in particular.
Yeah. One of our year-rounds, and that's with Citra and Amarillo. And, that was, you know, started as one of the beers that Mike and I worked on together.
It's one of the ones that stayed the truest to where we started it, too. That's one of the ones that was like, it's not a very complex recipe, but it, you know, it worked, and that was good enough.
Only everything else had been that easy.
Yeah.
Could I ask a question? I wanted to circle back around to the hop extract. Are you guys using a varietal extract, or are you just looking for alpha?
Primarily, we're just looking for alpha. I mean, there are varietal options out there, and I believe what we use is an Apollo-based CO2 extract. But, you know, what we've found is that, honestly, it doesn't make a huge difference. It's like at the 60-minute edition, really what you're getting is IBUs, and
Very close to the beginning of the boil for the most part. We're not doing, you know, Whirlpool extract additions or anything like that.
Yeah, and we're looking into some of the... It's actually fascinating. Like, a lot of the folks who make this stuff are coming up with new and interesting versions of it all the time that we're experimenting with. But, yeah, we're really just doing the initial IBU charge with the CO2. And we do that with all of our beers. Every single beer we do starts with CO2, including the Saison, the Omeo Coffee Stout, everything. And I think it's one of those things where there's a certain amount of mysticism and also a little bit of a prejudice against some of the higher tech stuff in that regard. And, you know, what we found doing blind side-by-sides, because there were times where, like, oh, we ran out, you know, the vendor ran out of CO2 extract, so we got to substitute Columbus or Apollo or something else in there, and you taste the final product. And if you were to do it blind, I mean, there's absolutely no way you could tell. And the nice thing about the CO2 extract is it's extremely consistent. It doesn't soak up any beer. It's each jar is 15 IBUs in a 30-barrel batch. So it's extremely easy to formulate with, and it gives a very clean bitterness, and it gives you a great deal of control, which is what it's all about, really.
And it's not going to clog any lines or filters or anything?
I mean, as long as you get a good... this was the problem we're running into with the homebrew scale, right, is that they... And I don't know if this had to do with it being, you know, the size of the kettle or the heat of the burner, because obviously we're using a steam-jacketed situation here, which is different, but we weren't getting it to dissolve fully in the homebrew kettle, whereas here, yeah, I mean, it dissolves right away, so...
Honestly, what I noticed, and I ended up throwing out most of mine, I would open some packets, and you would see the liquid. It's what it looked like here, this sort of pale... You know, light amber golden color. It would smell fresh. It would smell like hops. And then you'd open something, and it would sort of be a muddy brown and a lot thicker. I don't know if it was oxidized. It would smell like old hops. And so I was just doing that. I'd open one up, no. Open one up, no. And I ended up throwing about 8 away one day. I went, okay, I'm not buying any more of these.
Huh. And that's, you know, I wish that was the kind of thing that homebrewers had access to on a regular basis. I mean, it also, I think, would go a long way toward reducing some of the trepidation people feel around using those types of products, and but I think it's just a natural evolution. And you know, frankly, I think there's kind of a bigger philosophical question there too, which is that you don't need nearly as much acreage if you're taking this kind of approach to IBUs, right? And so you have to think about the hop market as a whole as kind of like aroma is kind of competing with IBUs for acreage, right? And what we're all experiencing is difficulty getting all the great aroma varieties that we'd love to have access to. And if I would love it if brewers would just stop using, you know, Amarillo or Simcoe for their IBUs and switch to the Apollos or the CO2 extract or whatever, because the overall effect of that would be that farmers could be replacing some of those IBU acres with aroma acres, and that, I think, would benefit everyone.
And we could actually taste them.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, some people are just absolutely adamant that a beer bittered with Amarillo or Simcoe or whatever is just essential to their version of that beer, and everyone's entitled to their opinion. Certainly, I feel differently, and I would encourage anyone to experiment.
There are a bunch of very well-known, very small, very passionate brewers who are all about CO2 extract for bittering. I mean, it's not just something bigger breweries are playing with. Some very artisanal places have decided that is how to make a better beer, and less green stuff in the kettle is going to give you less of that grassy flavor. We don't do a lot of mid-boil additions of hops. Really, it's extract and whirlpool. And then sometimes the hop back, is that still in use?
Yeah, we've actually stopped using the hop back. And, you know, and we did, that's another one of those things. I'm a huge believer in blind tasting. Like, if you cannot pull it out of a blind tasting in a triangle, then it doesn't do anything. No matter how much I want it to exist, no matter how much I want this thing to be true, if it doesn't show in a blind tasting, then it's just not worth it. And we ultimately decided the hop back was not worth it. So we adjusted, you know, with a combination of whirlpool and dry hop to make up for it, and we think we get better results because of it.
You raised your hand a second ago.
I did. I didn't want to interrupt. I think it's interesting that you mentioned philosophically that there's this resistance to the extracts, and it's unfortunate. There's been so much good work done, especially on the varietal extracts over the past few years, and we're just still in this backlash against, well, profitability, basically. But especially with these varieties that, you know, Simcoe, Amarillo, things, you know, let's let the hop producers spread out the supply so we don't have these busts.
Yeah, I mean, it's the hop market is in a complex place right now. I mean, on the one hand, things have certainly improved in supply in some areas because hop growers are really deeply investing in expanding their acreage and all that kind of thing, but we're also seeing an insane proliferation of new varieties. I mean, everybody's reaching back into the last decade of research that they've done and looking for those hops that at the time were just not going to sell, and today maybe they will. So we're, the hop market is expanding, but it's also kind of balkanizing, and we're getting more and more of these little niche varietals that may have very limited use, but it's kind of exciting to see the color palette expanding. But at the same time, we just need more raw acreage too of the varieties that because I have contracts through 2022 at this point. That's kind of how you have to do it, right? Because
that first 6 months, a lot of what you and Matt were doing was going on trying to buy on the spot market, swap, well, we've got a lot of Nelson but we need some Simcoe, who wants to trade, just to make it through to when those contracts, the first contracts, finally kicked in.
Yeah, and then, the thing that's interesting from a business perspective about that, right, is, like, it kind of forces you to plan your growth for the next, like, 7 years. And, like, brewing is already a business where scalability is an issue, right? It's not like a software company where you just infinitely produce the product until, as demand dictates. It's like, here, we're a very old-school business. It's bricks and mortar, and everything we make sits on a floor in a tank, yada, yada, and so... Now with this restriction on hop availability that we have, it even goes further down that path of requiring you to plan way in advance, but it also doesn't necessarily allow for, if my beer with Nelson becomes a huge hit, then I guess I'll just make, well, no, I won't make more of it, actually. So it's an interesting time, and I think the cool thing is that necessity is the mother of invention. So what we're... It's forcing us to think outside of the box and come up with options for not just growth, but options for creating beers that are every bit as exciting as those hoppy beers, but that do not use the things that are hard to get. So I think you will see other breweries doing the same thing, expanding their sour programs, expanding their barrel-aged beer programs, all things that are amazing that do not require some of those hop varieties. I think you'll see more and more of them.
Interesting. Well, this has been fun. I have to admit, I'm a little thirsty.
Cool. So let's get you a cup of cold brew coffee.
Woo! No, actually, I wouldn't mind. I like coffee as well. But Jacob, thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure.
And Mike Tonsmeyer, as always.
Oh, I'm glad we finally got you in here.
Yes. Cheers, everybody.
Yeah.
Cheers. Cheers.
Well, thanks again to Jacob and Mike, and of course to Steve, Andy, and Sean. Yet another place that I wish I lived closer to. The brewery itself is a really cool, funky space with a giant portrait of Michael Jackson with a monkey made of Post-it notes on the wall. And the bar, the base of the bar is made from stacks of books. It's very cool. And the beers are tasty as well. More from San Diego next week. In the meantime, if you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to james@basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Check out our support link where you can throw a couple of bucks into the tip jar by subscribing financially to our podcasts. Be sure to check out our DVDs, Extract Brewing and Partial Mashing, Stepping into All Grain, Low-Tech Lagering and Decoction Mashing, and Introduction to Wine Kits. You can find them all on our site. Get a free Basic Brewing bottle opener with any of our DVD combos right now. And you can check out our Basic Brewing shirts in the store as well. Along with the listing of the fine folks across the country who sell our DVDs, you can check that out at basicbrewing.com. And if there isn't a vendor in your area, you can order them online in our online shop at basicbrewingshop.com. Thanks to everybody who's continued to click on our Amazon.com link. We greatly appreciate the support there. Our featured products this week that were purchased through the link are Coolatron Coca-Cola Personal 6-Can Mini Fridge. Imagine you can put other things in there other than Coca-Cola. And Combat Source Kill 4 6 Ant Bait Stations kills queen and entire colony. Boy, I don't like ants in the house. Thanks again, everybody. Remember, I can't tell who bought what, so no worries there. Just click on the Amazon.com logo on our site. The next time you feel like Amazon shopping, we greatly appreciate your support. Don't forget, also, we have an associate link for Brew Your Own Magazine. And I usually talk about the associate link for the AHA, but this week, remember to go to the homebrewersassociation.org and click join and use the offer code BBR at checkout, and you get a free Designing Great Beers book. That's all until next time. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer, production help for Basic Brewing Radio, and our website is provided by Kelly Dodson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.